So welcome once again. My name is Nada Vasugian. I'm going to be talking about, the title of my talk today is The Gypsy Modernists, Viennese Architecture and Design Between the Two World Wars. I'm going to characterize and talk about a very specific narrative, narrative concerning Viennese modernism during the interwar period, one that isn't really so well known. Those of you who are familiar with Viennese interwar modernism may have heard of people like Joseph Hoffmann, the famous founder of the Wiener Werkstätte, or you may have heard of perhaps Adolf Loos, even, both of whom are remarkable designers in their own right. But this story, in a way, isn't going to revolve around them. We'll, in a sense, look at their context and certainly their intellectual contributions to the period, but we're going to look at Viennese modernism through the eyes of a very specific protagonist, who's actually all but unknown, I think, especially in the American context. And in part because this protagonist was someone who, like a lot of the most remarkable Viennese figures of the era, had his hand in a lot of different disciplines. And I think that was one of the most exciting and vibrant things about Viennese interwar architecture and design, that it wasn't divorced from what was happening in the arts, that it wasn't divorced from what was happening in philosophy or even in politics for that matter. And it's that nexus of relationships that I hope to highlight by concentrating on this on this case study. Where do we start? We start in Manchester, England. Why Manchester, England? Well, Manchester, England was really represented one of the central birthplaces of the Industrial Revolution. And Manchester, England was exemplified for a lot of very of leftist thinkers during the 19th century, all that was wrong with the modern metropolis and industrialized living. The most famous commentator on Manchester was Frederick Engels, the great interlocutor and collaborator of Karl Marx, who wrote, "In the industrial epoch alone has it become possible that the worker scarcely freed from feudal servitude could be used as mere material, that he must let himself be crowded into a dwelling too bad for every other, which he for his hard-earned wages buys the right to let go utterly to ruin." So if you're a good Marxist or even a good leftist, socialist utopian during the 19th century, you were rather skeptical of the possibilities that industrialized metropolitan life afforded in the way of equality, quality of life, and personal freedom. And so it was images like these that that surfaced to mind through the end of the 19th century that was sort of tantamount for a lot of leftist intellectuals to how they saw the city, that it was overcrowded, that it was unhygienic, and that it was ultimately inhumane. Now, this perception of the modern metropolis ultimately underwent a radical transformation at the turn of the 20th century. And a leader in that regard was a figure by the name of Ebenezer Howard, who was a British leader of the Garden City movement. And a second person, and someone that I'm going to concentrate on, who, in a sense, was interested in exploring ways in which we could rethink the modern metropolis so that it was more humane, was someone by the name of Otto Neurath. And that's the person we're going to talk about today. Now, who was this guy, Otto Neurath? Well, he was a polymath. He was an eclectic figure. He was a philosopher. In that rightmost image translates the scientific conception of the world, socialism and logical empiricism. He was a founder of the movement, a co-founder of the movement with Rudolf Carnap and Hans Hahn, known as the Vienna Circle, which founded a group called, they called themselves the logical empiricists or logical positivists. And they were primarily dedicated to rethinking science or rethinking philosophy along more scientific lines and extracting metaphysics from philosophy more broadly. So in that sense, they were very inspired by people like Ludwig Wittgenstein, who was also an important Viennese of the era. Neurath was also a director of a museum. The museum was the Museum of Society and Economy, Gesellschaft und Wirtschaft Museum, on the top. If any of you have been to Vienna, maybe you recognize the building in the center. It is the, well, then known as the new city hall. Today it's the regular city hall. And he directed the museum, and it had its headquarters in the city hall. In part because the museum had as much a social and political vision as it did a cultural one. And we're going to talk about that vision in the course of this lecture. Interestingly enough, it was a museum that was open on Sundays from 9 to 1, it says to your left. Tuesdays 5 to 7 and Fridays 5 to 7, and the reason being that that was really the only time that the worker could actually have had time to go to the museum, and that's something we'll talk about too. Neurath was intimately involved in architecture and settlement planning. To the right is a poster from an exhibition in which he was involved in 1932, which was sponsored by the International Werkbund, by the Austrian Werkbund. It was known as the International Werkbund Exhibition. And its organizer was someone by the name of Joseph Frank, who is also a very important modernist whom we'll talk about today. Finally, Neurath collaborated with graphic designers like Gerd Arnst, and he made this book called Modern Man in the Making, which was a great, spectacular hit in the late 1930s here in the United States, and really attempted to make accessible social and economic facts to wide audiences through pictorial means. Finally, he was an elephant. In the middle, he signed his correspondences with a picture of an elephant. It says, yours very sincerely. Boom. And maybe at the conclusion of this lecture, we can sort of speculate on what that means, and perhaps it'll make more sense as things go on. Now, what did Neurath have to say about people like Engels? And about Engels' analysis of the modern metropolis? Well, on the one hand, he completely identified with Engels' critique and of modern metropolitan life. In 1903, he was a graduate student, a doctoral student in Berlin. And Berlin was a real intellectual and cultural center at the turn of the 20th century. In part because it underwent such radical transformations, and these radical transformations inspired people like Ludwig Kirchner to really reflect what that could mean in the context of the arts, to explore what the speed and anonymity of the modern metropolis could mean in a cultural sense. Now, Neurath was affected by it as well, and he hated the city. It was a city that grew. That doubled in population between 1890 and 1910. He wrote to one of his mentors, Berlin does not simulate sightseeing very much, wealthy, but neither beautiful nor attractive. I miss our Austrian sociability everywhere. And when he thought about Berlin, he thought about images like this. This is what was known as a rental barrack or Mietskaserne. And the Mietskaserne were notorious for being overcrowded, for not affording a great deal of natural light. They're kind of like our tenements on the Lower East Side. And if you want to experience more of what our tenements were like here in New York City, I highly encourage you to go see the Tenement Museum, which is a really remarkable institution. But that's not the end of our story. Because obviously there was something redemptive for Neurath in modern metropolitan life, and that's something that I hinted at earlier. And one of the pivotal experiences that caused him to rethink his attitudes toward the modern city was actually World War I. Now, why World War I, and why war in general? How could war actually serve as a source of inspiration? Vienna, after all, or Austria as a whole, sustained greater number of casualties and deaths than any other country in the world. There were in excess of 2.5 million casualties. And as you can see here, there were people who were hungry, homeless, war veterans who had lost limbs, traumatized by this experience. Well, what Neurath found is that what war did is that it, while it was bad and caused lots of casualties, the ironic thing was that it in a way, created ideal conditions under which one could create and ultimately administer what he regarded as an ideal socialized economy. So he writes, "I see for the immediate future, the peace economy will be rearranged for military purposes more strictly so far, and it seems to me not to the disadvantages of the peacetime economy." The military... Anyway. What does he mean by that? Well, all throughout Vienna after World War I, the hardship that people sustained in places like Vienna as a result of World War I really went beyond the war itself and lasted through 1923. In this image is actually an image of people in a barter market. And this is actually one of the images that Norit drew a great deal of inspiration from, that while war produced hardship, ironically, what he found is that certainly for the most downtrodden, it over the long term improved the standard of living and gave rise to barter markets such as these and more communal forms of association. It appears that in some regions at some times one can buy 1 kilogram of salt for 1 kilogram of meat, 1 kilogram of sugar for 1 kilogram of butter. This experience should move us all to organize barter exchanges and make it available to all. So how did this impact his attitudes toward the city? I think we can learn a lot by looking at an image like this. This is an image, actually, that I got from an archive, from his archive in England. And it's a remarkable image because it shows a juxtaposition of two ways of living. On the one hand, an agricultural way of living. On the other hand, an industrialized way of living, as you can see on the left. These were, to the right, were what were known as Schrebergartens. These were basically day gardens that people, working class people, had often at the edge of the city that offered them a brief respite from the toils of daily life. Now, what served as a form of recreation during peacetime, during wartime, actually became a central means of subsistence. That as a result of the war and wartime struggle, the fact that they didn't have access to resources, goods, foods, etc., materials, people had to literally grow their own crops. And they had to squat, in some cases, on municipal lands inside the city, outside the city, at the city's edge, in effort to survive. And this wasn't just an isolated phenomenon. As many as, let's say, a full 10% of the population actually lived in this fashion, were literally squatting. And it wasn't just the people that were already downtrodden. It was actually educated professionals, teachers, bankers, and so forth, who were basically tending to their own crops and actually raising their own cattle. And what Norit believed was that in an ideal sort of metropolis, one would be able to actually synthesize the best aspects of agricultural self-help with those of modernized industry. Right? And in a way, this was his response to the conundrum, or rather to the difficulties that modern industrialized life posed to people who thought about cities, and in particular thought about how everyday people lived in cities. When we think about city planners, in New York, maybe we think about Robert Moses, maybe we think about Haussmann, Paris's Haussmann, we think about Le Corbusier, who were all saw themselves as sort of master planners, right? A famous quip about Moses is that he loved the public but hated the people. Well, in a way, Norit was of a very different ilk. This was an image taken from a National Geographic magazine issue from 1923, and it shows a one of the families that were sort of forced to improvise their lives. And make do on an ad hoc basis. And it was really by looking at them and studying their habits that Norit evolved a new theory about planning, and the one that really revolved around the idea about what we might call gypsy urbanism, right? Or citizen-based planning. And they were actually euphemistically referred to as gypsy settlers. The caption of this image reads, "The baby's father is a carpenter and built the wagon in the picture from an old packing case and painted it bright blue." So the idea was that these people were able to repurpose things that existed around them in order to survive. And ultimately, there was a sense of accountability, and there was a participatory dimension to what they were doing. And Neurath recognized in that a new model for planning, not just a new model for citizenship, but a model for planning cities, one in which people actually played an active role in shaping their urban environments. So one of the problems that this kind of what we might call gypsy urbanism posed, this kind of ad hoc squatting posed for political officials and for planners in the city, was that it was disorderly, right? This image reads, "The coal shortage in Vienna caused the denuding of this forest." So what does Neurath do in order to respond to this criticism that was often raised? The fact that all these squatters on the edges of the city from, let's say, 1917 to 1923 were basically living and squatting on municipal lands and hoarding wood from the forest, but in a disorderly fashion. What he does is he sets up an educational institute. And it was known as the Settlement and Allotment Garden Association. And the purpose of the Settlement Allotment Garden Association is to help undo the modern metropolis by leaving apartment construction and administration to cooperatives, housing groups, and related organizations, and by consolidating all matters relating to housing construction from the production of raw materials to the construction of finished homes. What it means is this. To the left, you can see an image of a family squatting outside the city, making a sort of makeshift dwelling that actually they lived on, not on a temporary basis, but for a number of years. On the right, however, you also see self-help laborers. These are people that ultimately built homes that they lived in, but they were doing so according to the prescriptions and advice and oversight of trained architects. In Neurath's case, they also mindful of the invention of the assembly line and efforts to revolutionize industry through the assembly line, and were adopting Fordist production methods, but for the purpose of promoting informal settlement design and planning. In other words, self-help based planning.
Would you know the name in German of the settlement?
Can I just bracket it and answer that at the end?
Okay.
Let's do it at the Q&A, but I won't forget that. What tools did the Settlement and Allotment Garden Association have at its disposal? Well, it had a publication known as Der Siedler, The Settler, and which offered people advice on how most effectively to grow tomatoes, how to make shoes out of wood rather than rubber, how to make a jacket out of rabbit fur, and the like. They also staged protests. They had a reputation for being bohemians or anarchists, so it was really important that they made a firm show of unity and discipline. And so this was actually an important protest that they held in 1921 in front of the city hall. And on the stool, on the pedestal there, is actually the city's first social democratic mayor, Jakob Reumann. To the right was in the middle ground is actually the logo of this settlement movement. The logo was designed by Adolf Loos. It shows a shovel and a triangle showing this kind of unity of the intellect and the hand, right? Thinking and working. Adolf Loos was a central sort of player in this movement. He administered one of the most important sort of settlement offices. Finally, what I want to talk about is in the left side of the image, you can actually see Neurath himself. He's this big burly guy, this big scary looking guy. He was incredibly brilliant, but he was also an incredible vigilant sort of propagandist and actually labor organizer as well. With wagons, automobiles, and music, the settlers and allotment gardeners marched along, carrying along their characteristic poster boards. "Give us land, wood, and stone, and we'll make bread out of it." Finally, they staged exhibitions, right? And their exhibitions served a number of purposes. First of all, it would educate people about what they were doing and encourage converts. It was also, I think, an opportunity to show many of the remarkable innovations that they developed. And this was also staged in the center of the city in front of the new town hall. Now, what did they say about it? In the vestibule to the ballroom, there's a fur and fur usage exhibit. It is illustrated here what one can make out of rabbit fur. It is probable that the rabbits of allotment gardeners and small animal farmers will be used less for their meat than for their fur, because the usage of fur yields more things. This is an image from one of the local municipal papers from the period of showing all the fruits and crops that these people yielded, that their fields yielded, and that they were able to design, or rather cultivate, of their own accord. Finally, there was a housing exhibit at the settlement, on the site. And it was a housing exhibit of houses that people could build on their own, right? Now, probably the most important housing design, or certainly the most important housing design on the site, was produced by a very young architect by the name of Margareta Szlachotsky. Now, Margareta Szlachotsky is still virtually unknown outside of Austria. But I think that, you know, when... I think that, you know, in the coming generation, when historians are really kind of rethinking modernism, that she will really be one of the vital and canonic figures in that narrative. She's a vastly understudied person. There's still not a single full-length monographic text, but she revolutionized architecture and design and interior design in a number of ways. She was the first professionally trained, or one of the first professionally trained women architects in Austria. She later became most famous for designing the first fully prefabricated kitchen, a kitchen that used fully prefabricated components in working-class neighborhoods in Frankfurt. Finally, she was one among the first people to try and adopt Friedrich Winslow Taylor's time motions scientific management studies for the purpose of reforming the interior environment. And we'll see, and you'll get in a sense of what that means in just a minute when I show you the designs that she produced. Now, for this exhibit, she showed a series of houses known as Kernhäuser, core houses. Now, what was a core house? Now, a core house was a house that could be built in phases, right? Now, it's actually a house, a design that we can learn a lot from today. Today, you know, we build temporary and emergency shelters for refugee enclaves, but there are some refugee camps that actually exist now for almost half a century. What do you do in such instances? Well, she addressed this problem that a lot of emergency dwelling ends up being permanent dwelling, by creating a housing type that could actually serve both purposes. This was a house that you could build in phases. If you had no money and a small family, you can build one single room on a plot. If you once your family expanded, and if you're of greater means, you could actually build out the house. So what was originally a single family freestanding home would eventually turn into a row, right? And each one had provisions for a private garden. The other interesting feature was that you could build the first floor. There was a plan for just building a single floor in a single room, and then attaching a second floor, converting a, a stall for containing your animals into a second bedroom adjunct. So there are all kinds of flexible ways in which you could adopt this home. The purpose being that people needed these homes very quickly. And affordably. So this courthouse makes it possible for anyone who is able to get together the amount to move into a cheery three-bedroom dwelling within 5 to 10 weeks that can offer shelter for a couple of years until he or she secures the means to expand. So you could produce this thing very quickly and inexpensively, and you built it yourself. But this is a view of the interior of an ink drawing of an interior that she produced, and here you can really, I think, gain appreciation of her own deep understanding of how to design in a time and space saving manner. How does she do that? Well, these were very small dwellings ultimately, so it was really important that you economize with respect to your use of space. And one way she does that is by pushing all of the programs, you know, sitting, eating, and so forth, cooking to the sides, the edges of the room. And really trying to utilize the wall space as best she could for the purpose of storage, cooking, sitting, communing, and so forth. This is a photograph that shows the subheading here says, a few small To the right is the house in its first phase. To the in the left is the house in its second phase, right? And this was very important in Vienna during this time because, as I mentioned before, there were lots of people that came back from the war wounded or blind. People had all kinds of different needs and all kinds of different economic circumstances as well. So it was really important that you develop a type that could be both prefabricated, so it was inexpensive, but which was also flexible enough to accommodate a bunch of different economic, people's different economic needs, family needs, and also their varying skills. These were, again, homes that people built on their own, so they had to be done communicated in a way that people could understand. Another interesting aspect of this whole self-help cooperative building initiative was that in the minds of the planners, it actually promoted equality. That as a result of the war, there were lots of dead men, and far fewer men than there were women. And so women were, they were really able to bring women into the workplace in ways that they couldn't before, and have them actively involved in construction. Now, the settlement movement ultimately failed. And this headline reads, "The End of the Settlement Movement." It failed for a variety of reasons. Basically, the municipal government in the city stopped providing money for them because it basically took too long to build these settlement homes. That the demand far outstripped the supply, and it simply took a long time to train people. And then finally, the economy stabilized. And as the economy stabilized, people said, "Well, I can afford now to pay someone else to build my home. I'm going to go back to teaching." Now, what was Neurath's response to that? We're going to talk about that in a minute. But here he writes, "The settlement house will always remain a more evolved type of dwelling. However, we recognize that the high-rise apartment has time on its side due to the present economic circumstances." So this whole self-help-based planning movement that he developed ultimately went for a nosedive and lost out to the high-rise and to high-rise construction. So what does he do? He then starts a museum. And this is a very important sort of next chapter in our story because although the settlement movement failed, this guy, Neurath, didn't really give up as far as citizen participation was concerned. And in fact, rather than promoting agricultural self-help and self-help forms of construction, instead he wanted to promote self-help through education by informing the urban citizenry about issues that affected their daily lives so that they could partake in its deliberations in a more active way. So, as I noted before, this museum was open at night so that workers could visit it. There were tourist films. The goal was to educate the working class masses about production, emigration, mortality, interior furnishing, unemployment, the fight against tuberculosis, alcoholism, so on and so forth. Right? So it was really educating people about the city, but not the city in the sense of, you know, just streets and roadways, but the city in the comprehensive sense, the city as a state, as a society, as a community, and not just as a physical artifact. This is an interior view of the exhibition hall. Again, it was inside the town hall because it was as much about raising civic consciousness as it was about educating people broadly. Now, there are a lot of interesting things about this town hall. First of all, it was one of the first exhibition spaces to make use of artificial lighting. Why is that important? It's important because, in a way, it... certainly, in this case, it had the effect of democratizing the modern museum in time. That, namely, workers who were on the 9-to-5 schedule could all of a sudden learn stuff during the evenings. Secondly, and probably more importantly, there was nothing in this museum that could not be reproduced. You come to MoMA, you come to see Les Demoiselles d'Avignon, you come to see A Starry Night. These are all exceptional pieces that you can only find here. And in many respects, historically, museums have been defined by the fact that they're scarce everywhere else. And what he wanted to do was the very inverse of that, to say that museums should not collect things that are singular, and but rather things that you could actually reproduce, and hence things that could also be more accessible to wider audiences in varying spheres of their lives. The design of this interior was by a very close interlocutor, collaborator of Neuhardt, known as Joseph Frank, who was also, I think, a remarkable architect and modernist in his own right, and was really seminal in terms of really giving shape to this this vision of the museum. Neuhardt writes, "We have reached the point where in the great metropolis the decentralization of the museum is afoot. These museums should not be treated as central monuments, not as central monumental locations, but as moving structures that can transform depending on the purpose of the exhibition." They had an exhibition here, for instance. This was one of the important, what were known as Gemeindebauten, in Vienna. These were super block housing complexes. These were multi-story, 5- and 6-story walk-up apartment complexes intended for this, for working class families. Now, they had a variety of different public amenities. They had daycare services, they had cultural facilities. So in some cases, they also had communal kitchen services. But it also had an exhibition space, and Neuhardt partook in that and in installing work there. Now, the reason this is very important, and I think especially radical in the case of Vienna, is because of what it did to the city. Now, if you've been to Vienna before, you know that everything, all the life of the city, even today, revolves around the ring. Many of the most important liberal institutions are there: the Parliament Building, the City Hall, the University. At the center of this were formerly the Baroque palaces, part of the Baroque palace complex of the monarch. And so it's really a capital city that really where the sort of locus of cultural, political, and social power was really at center. And what Neuhardt wanted to do, and some of the people around him, was to really break that monopoly, to really bring culture and to bring knowledge, for that matter, to the rest of the city, and in particular to these settlements. So that's why exhibits like this were important. They also staged exhibits at street corners, right, as you can see here. It was seen by 2,000 people every day, this exhibit, some using it as a sort of waiting room and others going there for some minutes every day for knowledge and amusement. So we think about a museum and going to the museum as a contemplative and withdrawn experience. For him, it was the very inverse. Let's design culture and make it accessible to the masses more broadly, right? Let's take the language of mass culture in order to promote Enlightenment thought, which sounds like a paradoxical proposition, but I think an ambitious and in some ways compelling one nonetheless. It's in a view of people engaging and interacting with some of the work that they saw around them. Finally, the Museum of Society and Economy developed a means of visual communication, a pictorial means of visual communication. And I don't really need to go into it here, but one of the interesting things about it was that they wanted to develop a method of pictorial education that everyone could find accessible, whether they were Czech and couldn't speak German, or they were American and English or German, and which also everyone could in themselves create and partake in making. So in the base of this, he describes not just how to communicate talk about science and education pictorially, but also how to make it. And he says, for instance, these things should be made with scissors, because because most people can work with scissors and mount pictures on a piece of paper, hence participating in the production of knowledge. So it could especially would be useful to the teaching of children in schools. Now, this was one of the earliest pictorial charts they created. Police arrest in Vienna in February 1925, along 7 days from the effects of alcohol without the effects of alcohol. This is the effect of alcohol without the effects of alcohol, right? They were so good social democrats, and many of the social democrats were involved in various anti-alcohol campaigns, and so this, I think, chart, I think, lent itself to promoting that awareness about, or promoting that initiative in some ways. Modern man is very spoiled by cinnamon illustrations. He receives his education in the most comfortable of means, partly during periods of rest through optical impressions. If one seeks to disseminate socio-scientific education generally, one must use similar means of representation. The modern advertisement will show us the way. Right? In some ways, there's some truth to it. I teach architectural history, and I'm actually quite struck often. I find myself feeling quite struck by how much my students really do learn watching the History Channel. Of course, there are limits to that way of thinking, but those are the lines along which he was thinking as well. Eventually, a very important graphic designer came into the office by the name of Gerd Arndt. And Gerd Arndt came from Cologne, and he was part of this sort of constructivist axis of design in Germany. When he arrived in the museum, he was charged with doing a couple of things. First of all, he mechanized their production methods so they could distribute information more widely. Second of all, he overhauled the pictorial language that the museum had as disposal. Before, they were sort of feeling around for using different vocabularies, different forms of representation. When Gerd Arndt arrived, they settled on this much more standardized language that you could use in a variety of different media contexts, for charts, in booklets, in films even. And this was, again, is, I think what they were trying to convey is, I'm not sure, I was going to say it's self-evident, but it isn't necessarily. What is important is that he wanted to provide a synoptic, or give people synoptic a view of, in this instance, the automobile industry in a way that they could immediately grasp and understand. In fact, if you spent too long having to look at it and study it, they thought it was a poorly designed chart. It was really about designing knowledge and communicating knowledge in an age of distraction. They very quickly got sort of branched out into a variety of different media, right? Again, about bringing bringing knowledge into people's everyday lives through children's books like The Colorful World, through pamphlets. This is one that was distributed by a municipal insurance agency, by educational pieces. Pictorial Statistics was a booklet that they had called Bildstatistik. And then finally, through posters. That poster to the left describes the responsibilities of the chambers of workers and employees. It was basically a worker, an employee support and advice agency, right, where you would go to get advice about how to deal with labor problems, problems you might have with your boss, about how to find a job, legal advice, so on and so forth. And these are among the services that the Social Democrats offered. So it was really a way of communicating their goals.
What year
on
that poster?
Can I answer that at the very end? Mm-hmm. Just hold on to the very end and remind me, and I promise that I'll get there. Mm-hmm. Finally, they said, well, they began to really think about not just reproducing the contents of the museum, but reproducing museums themselves. Can we mass produce museums the way Henry Ford did automobiles? Right? So they opened satellites all over the world. They opened one satellite in The Hague, for instance. This was known as the International Foundation for Visual Education. They opened a satellite in Moscow. They opened a satellite in London. They opened a satellite in Berlin-Kreuzberg. They opened even a satellite in New York. And in fact, during the 1930s, during the mid-1930s, NORAD had a huge impact on many of the sort of leadership figures involved in the New Deal initiatives. And in fact, they used and adopted his graphic vocabulary for the purpose of promoting many of the more popular New Deal programs here in the United States. This was a postcard issued by the International Foundation for Visual Education in The Hague in 1938. I think it's aesthetically remarkable and formally inspired, but incredibly, in some ways, incredibly cynical, right? That you have these, masses of people going in and literally pictures coming out. And when I saw this image, the question I asked myself is, what happened to the gypsy settler, right? What happened to that participatory vision of planning and design that he was so enamored of during the 1920s, and that the circle around him was so enamored of during the 1920s? And one of the only ways I can account for it is by thinking about the political context of the time, right? This is on the eve of the Second World War, and Norit himself was a figure who, in 1934, had to flee Austria because they were fascist powers in the country who were after him. They weren't national socialists, but they were fascists. And then ultimately also had to leave the Netherlands, which was annexed, invaded, and ultimately annexed by the Nazis at the start of World War II. So this was someone, in a way, who I think over the course of the 1920s and 30s became deeply disenchanted with citizen-based planning. Right, that the very working class that he believed would bring about its own revolutionary culture ultimately, certainly in Vienna, aspired to having some of the very same bourgeois accoutrements that the liberal ruling class had. And worse than that, over the course of the 1930s, they gravitated towards a much more, they gravitated towards totalitarian forms of governance. They didn't want to participate, in a sense. And so I think that disillusionment with participatory visions of planning, I think, ultimately led him to become a little bit more of a technocrat and someone who more looked to technology and the mass media in particular in order to promote the dissemination of knowledge and information. Now, this brings me, I think, to the conclusion of this talk. I produced a book and more importantly, an exhibition that relates to my research on this subject matter. The exhibition took place in The Hague. And why was it in The Hague? Well, it was in part because I think Gerd Arndt in particular, who worked with Neurath, ended up spending his life there and really defined the landscape of graphic design for much of the 1950s and 1960s in that context. One issue we dealt with in particular that I was interested in exploring in the show was what I thought about Neurath's conceit that we could mass produce the modern museum. In my conclusion, and the conclusion that the exhibition designers and I arrived at was ultimately that we were ambivalent. That there, you know, we see and recognize the importance and the utility of mechanized forms of artistic production, cultural production, but we also wanted to insist an idea about of place and site specificity. So hence we had posters that you could take home with you, sort of mass producing the show, the contents of the show with descriptions, but we also had original objects, right? Which Neurath would have hated. This was one of the important, the seminal pieces in the show. It was a historical table designed for a very significant 1935 city planning exhibition that took place in Amsterdam. It was an aggressively anti-capitalist piece. And for that reason, it was actually pulled down after a single day. And one of the exciting things about the show was that this was the first time that it had actually been shown publicly in Holland since that time. We projected the contents of the show onto the street, hence, in a sense, trying to bring the show into the streets. And we also had films. Neurath collaborated in making a number of films during the 1930s using his pictorial means of graphic representation. He produced a number of folios. You can see 100 of those folio charts on the wall. These were basically things you can actually find them in your library today, but they could double as traveling exhibits. Right? The book could be function as a traveling exhibit. You kind of take out its contents and install it on your wall. Right? Again, a sort of museum in miniature. These are some of the other materials that we've talked about a little bit. Survey Graphic to the right was actually the most important popularizers of the New Deal and the values that stood for here in the United States during the 1930s. So we had the privilege of showing that too. I'm working on another show now, but we really don't have time to go into it that relates to it. But thank you very much for your attention. I'm here and open to your questions. My pleasure. Yes.
Two things. What was the name of that woman architect?
Margareta Schutte-Lahotsky. S-C-H-U-E-T-T-E. Yeah, T-T-E, hyphen, Lihotzky, L-I-H-O-T-Z-K-Y.
Okay, the other part of the question is, what she did with the prefab house that
Right.
And are you acquainted with Levittown?
Sure, sure.
I mean, he didn't plan it.
Right,
way,
right.
But the house was prefab.
Right.
They did it in mass production.
Right.
And it was very easy to extend.
Right.
If you go to Levittown
today,
now, a,
you can't even recognize those homes.
House
right.
Is a museum piece.
Right. Yeah, I mean, there are differences. I mean, Levittown. Levittown was also, based on promoting suburban housing types, and these settlements, in some ways, were also settled suburban. The difference is, though, that there was that Levittown was not an inclusive settlement, right? I mean, some of the people who lived there were beneficiaries. Many of them were beneficiaries of the GI Bill. In that sense, it was economically inclusive, but certainly not socially, because. Because of the racist policies that ultimately actually were often used in selling them.
I mean,
yes, exactly. So there, I think there is significant. I think you're right that there is there are common strains, and in some ways, I think Levittown would be unthinkable without modernism. Ironically enough, that a lot of the modernist city planners themselves after World War II get into suburban settlement or suburban housing development. I think, but Levittown was really devoid of any of the social values.
No, because they had community. They had
that's true.
Centers.
Right.
They put up libraries
right.
in Queens.
Right. Right.
And they had pools.
Right.
A lot of people bought houses there
right.
because there were pools.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, that's point well taken. Yeah. What was your? You had a question about a poster before.
No. What are your the poster of?
I'm trying to remember which one it was.
There was a Die Bunte Welt.
I'm
like
sorry.
That.
Die Bunte Welt. That was from 1929.
1929.
Yes. Yeah. Yes.
You mentioned Ebenezer Howard.
Yeah.
And you were talking about the gypsy.
Yeah.
Planning. Uh-huh. Yada, yada. I'm missing the link between
which Ebenezer
museum,
Howard.
Well,
yeah, the museum and the settlement movement.
Right. Just bring that together.
Sure.
Me,
the museum was about promoting citizen participation by having people build their own homes. The settlement movement was about promoting citizen participation by having people build their own homes. The museum was about promoting settlement participation by through education. Right. You know more stuff, hence you feel more invested in, hence you're more informed where making decisions is concerned.
But Howard was doing kind of the same thing in England.
Howard was different. Howard was similar, you're absolutely right, where settlement planning was concerned, because Howard also wanted to promote a vision of communal suburban settlement development. Howard was also trying to build this along cooperative lines. One of the differences with Howard, and there are, I think, a couple of them, one of the differences is that Howard was not, they certainly weren't as developed where industrialized forms of production were concerned and using prefab production. And in addition to that, more importantly, they didn't actually rely on this idea about self-help building. That wasn't really part of. In fact, the way that Howard wanted to finance those garden cities wasn't through labor; it was through capital, right? And that was one of the. It was by basically appealing to the good conscience of enlightened financiers, people like who's that famous soap concern? They have the very famous Gordon Bunshaft building across town. Sorry. Lever, the Lever family guy in England actually who ended up being one of the financiers of the Garden City movement, but that's neither here nor there. But those are some of the important differences.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yes?
Is there anything, I was thinking, sorry, I'm laryngitis. The kitchen, prefab kitchen
mm-hmm.
you did.
Yeah.
I saw something like IKEA, somebody has something.
Yeah.
Does that include appliances?
Does it, is there, sorry?
Appliances? How can you just put that in?
Well, Shadow Lahotsky ended up, that was not, what I showed was not a prefab kitchen. I mean, it was a prefab kitchen, but it wasn't. What she eventually developed was a prefab kitchen that was constructed entirely off-site and hauled into site with a crane. And it was basically completely factory-made and factory-produced, and you could simply plug it into the site. And this was in Frankfurt. And the model that she studied in deriving those types was the kitchens of rail cars, like railroad cars, because there you similarly had to deal with these spatial issues and the spatial constraints. And what she wanted to do was to really maximize use per square foot, you know, and also economize with respect to how far you had to walk, for instance, from the kitchen to the dining area, which no one had really thought of. I mean, it was just, you know, those choices were much more governed by just habit and convention prior to that time. In fact, before she came up with that kitchen, people would eat, bathe, and cook pretty much in the same space. Yes?
Did all European cities have these settlements outside the canals, just Austria and Germany?
You find them in Austria, you see them in Germany, even today, they're actually quite fashionable now. They're very hip to have one of these gardens in Berlin, for instance, on the edge of the city. In the Netherlands, they're popular too. I think that they're most common in Central Europe. It's mostly the German speaking. In the Czech Republic. Well, those, you know, Austro-Hungary.
You have to buy your piece of land.
Yeah. Right. Yes?
Regarding all the graphic design.
Yes.
The educational proportions.
Right. Sorry?
Pontus Hilton.
I don't know who that is. Who is that?
He's the director of Stedelijk Museum Amsterdam.
Oh.
In the 70s, and he widely promoted the use of graphic design.
Well, you know, Stedelijk Museum, actually that large piece that I showed you was actually there in 1935 before it was pulled. And again, in even when you, especially today, and I should say again that, you know, today we see pictograms everywhere, in airports and, you know, wherever. And the important thing to bear in mind is that actually, while this language had a history, of course, before the 20s, it was really systematized and understood as a systematic language, I think, for the first time during this period. And certainly through Neurath and the people that surrounded him, Gerd Arnst, really made that happen. So it's actually really pivotal in a lot of different ways. When you go to Holland in particular, I think that they just have a... they and the Japanese have the richest traditions of graphic design in the world. And I think that certainly where pictorial forms of visual communication are concerned, it was really dominant. It's dominant there today, and it was dominant in the 50s and 60s too, and in part because there's also a very strong planning culture there, right? I mean, it's a country that's always sinking. Right, yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Doesn't it show again that so much depends on the basic political conditions?
Absolutely.
In the city.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing in Neurath's case was that he was also aided to a great extent by, not just by the Social Democrats, but also by Quaker missionaries. Actually, he was partly financed by the Society of Friends from the United States and England. So, yes, the impetus is, to a large extent, political. These were Social Democrats, and none of this would have been possible
because
without them.
1934.
Right. Forget it. Pull the plug is pulled. Forget it. Yeah, it was all done. And some of these institutions had a life after 34, but it was a shadow of its former self. I mean, they became just gross parodies of what they were before. So yeah, it would have been unthinkable, I think, of really achieving this. This kind of thing under other circumstances. And again, I mean, it was also that, you know, these were people who were, this was also a time where there was, and in a way, Vienna was possible, that it was where people really knew each other from, you know, if you were, you know, philosophers knew politicians, and politicians knew artists, and artists knew designers. And so I think there was a way in which you could, I'm sorry, I'll just ignore that, you could collaborate across different spheres of life in a way that I think is quite different. The other important thing to bear in mind in Vienna was that Vienna functioned virtually as a city-state during the 1920s and 1930s. So they had a lot more autonomy and control. I think that I think it would have been difficult if they had to deal, much more difficult if they had to deal with the national government. Yeah.
When they were building those settlements, did they have competition or, I don't know what to call it, distrust from commercial builders?
They had, yes, there was a huge tension between the unions, because the unions were saying, look, these people are taking our jobs, well, you know. And there were no commercial builders to speak of, because no one could afford the materials, the whole distribution mechanisms, the import export mechanisms were basically in shambles. So and money didn't take you very far. Inflation was very, very high. So these were emergency circumstances, and rather than they legalized the squatting. They said, okay, some of you people are squatting on these lands, and we're going to continue to do it, and we're going to give you advice and oversight, but we're going to try to help provide you with some guidance by pairing you up with some talented architects and planners. And they had schools, they had adult education schools where they would actually teach you about gardening and animal husbandry and things like that, domestic hygiene. Yes?
It reminds me of the local food movement that we are having now. And there was just an article about some guy who owns a cow.
Right.
And he's going to get his own milk.
Right.
Somebody has a sheep.
Yes. In fact, I live next door to a butcher shop that will sell every part of the cow. It just gets the whole cow and they cut it up and sell every part. And, you know, I think that definitely, I think that the sustainability movement generally, I think, learns its best lessons by studying either poor countries like Cuba or people living in emergency circumstances. Because I think that there's actually a fundamental, for me anyway, there's actually a fundamental gap. And people like Al Gore wouldn't agree with me on this, but I think there's a fundamental gap between capitalism and sustainability. That capitalism really thrives on consumption. To have an economy in a capitalist society, you have to have a growing economy. And I think that's completely at odds with the premises of sustainable living, which involve repurposing, adaptive reuse, recycling. So I think that we still, I think, philosophically, haven't really figured out a sustainable way of living. I mean, even today, when we talk about economic policy, it's, you know, how do we get the consumer economy back on its feet? And the problem with that is that it's completely incompatible with the environmental goals of this country.
Most of them don't live like that themselves.
Sorry?
Most of the environmentalists, it fascinates me, don't live like that themselves. They live very grandly.
Yeah, well, that's another, I mean, you could debate that, but she was just saying that most of the environmentalists are like themselves, that they live grandly. That's debatable. Sorry?
They don't practice with
I don't want to generalize. They're good environmentalists.
As a group.
Sorry?
As a group.
Yeah, but I don't want to generalize as a group. It's not fair.
You just did, though.
I did?
Yeah.
Okay. Maybe. Any other questions? All right, well, thank you very much for your attention. Thanks very much for coming to Feedback.